The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Katie Neuhauser for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. And the first article for today is entitled, How American Jewish Immigrants Invented Childhood. I remember a Gahan Wilson article from some years ago. A group of toys are huddled together in an attic. One of them says, next time he comes up here to look at us, that's when we get him. Imagine meeting all of the joyful distractions of your childhood. Teddy bears, toys, games, dolls, children's books, trading cards, comics, model trains, children's shows on television. Well, that is what Michael Kimmel's new book, Playmakers, The Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America, will do for you. It will reintroduce you to your childhood, and it will lift that experience up for you in a way that you could never have imagined. But it is the story of the first generation Jewish immigrants who created the toy industry. The Kimmel has written something much larger than a history of toys. He has written a cultural history of modern America, and at its heart is a powerful claim that culture could not have existed without Jews. First-generation Jews were central to the creation of contemporary childhood. They created the toys, the dolls, the games, and puzzles for children, enchanted their imaginations, and inspired their fantasies of superhero powers or glamour or teenage popularity. They created the advice books for anxious parents, the advice columns in newspapers and magazines, and the fields of child and developmental psychology. In their struggle over the course of the 20th century to assimilate, they stood out, transforming the culture they sought to embrace. They were the children of refugees from pogroms. They had grown up in poverty, and so they imagined something different for the next generation, a childhood they themselves had never had. They created the toys, the games, the books, the comics, and the stories that created our collective childhoods. We might even say they invented the idea of childhood itself. This is not just a story of success or achievement. It is a story of what it means to be an outsider and to live between worlds. These Jews were simultaneously insiders and outsiders. They learned the language, the customs, and the rhythms of America, but at the same time, they carried memories and identities from somewhere else. Children are outsiders, too. They stand at the edge of the adult world looking in. They are learning its rules, its dangers, and its possibilities. They are both vulnerable and hopeful. Perhaps that is why so many Jewish creators were drawn to the world of childhood. For me, the ultimate Jewish creation in modernity is the superhero. It was not only the hidden superpower that a hero could utilize at precisely the right time. It was deeper than that. What could be more Jewish than a secret identity and a double life? As a child, the idea that an ordinary person could live in two worlds at once, one visible, one hidden, fascinated me. Kimmel's book made me remember. When I was no more than 10 years old, I started a little neighborhood newspaper. I typed each copy by hand. It had a circulation of about 5 and lasted for 2 issues. That was the beginning of my writing career. I now realize that I wanted to be Clark Kent and maybe even Superman. Recall the stories of kids who injured themselves by jumping off roofs in imitation of Superman. Why were so many comic book creators Jewish? Because if certain professions were closed off, you found new paths. If you couldn't become an advertising illustrator, you created comic books. If you couldn't enter established literary circles, you wrote for children. If you couldn't break into traditional business networks, you built your own. Kimmel points out that the moral panic over comic books in which parents participated might have been essentially anti-Semitic. An editorial in the Hartford Courant referred to comics as the filthy stream that flows from the gold-plated sewers of New York, a barely concealed dog whistle synonym for Jewish businesses. America, for all its flaws, allowed for that kind of reinvention. It offered something that Europe did not, space to create new industries. Toys, comics, children's books, film, and television were emerging fields. The established elites did not dominate them. They were open and fluid, places where people on the margins could build something new. Consider the teddy bear. It began as a bear that former President Theodore Roosevelt hunted and shot. But in a Brooklyn candy store, immigrants turned it into a toy. But more than a toy, it became an object of comfort, something to hold at night, something that could absorb a child's fears. That represented a new phenomenon. Children were not just small adults being prepared for the workplace. Why do you think child labor laws are necessary? They were emotional beings who needed care, imagination, and protection. But even as Jewish entrepreneurs helped shape American culture, the inner circles of that culture still did not fully accept them. They could influence what Americans read, watched, and played with, but they were still, in some sense, outsiders. That was a blessing, because when you are slightly outside, you see things differently. You notice what others take for granted. You ask new questions. You imagine new possibilities. In that sense, this story is not just about Jews. It is about immigrants. It is about anyone who has stood at the edge of society and dreamed of creating something better for the next generation. In that sense, this is an American story. When I look back at the toys and stories of my own childhood, I see them differently now. I see them as expressions of hope. I see them as attempts to create safety in an unsafe world. I see them as gifts from one generation to the next. And I see something else, too. I see another explanation of anti-Semitism. Perhaps it is because so many people have come to realize how much of their daily lives, even and especially in the things they barely notice, is a result of Jewish vision and invention. Anti-Semitism is not only hatred, it is a dark resentment and even jealousy. And beyond that, Jewish immigrants invented some of the biggest ideas that America has offered the world. Children matter. Imagination is crucial. Play is not frivolous, but formative. It was a way of saying the future deserves better than the past. That might be the most Jewish idea of all. And this ends the first article. Our next article is entitled, "The U.S. is the only country where most say fellow citizens' morality is bad," survey finds. Out of 25 countries, the United States was the only one where most people said their fellow citizens' morality was generally bad, new research has found. A Pew Research Center report, Examining Morality and Ethics, released on Thursday, March 5th, also found self-identified Christians are more likely to view abortion, using marijuana, homosexuality, having extramarital affairs, and other behaviors as morally unacceptable than other groups. The report marks the first time Pew researchers asked respondents about their views on the morality of their fellow citizens. In total, more than half of American adults, 53%, said the morality and ethics of people in their country were somewhat bad or very bad, while 47% rated their morality as good or very good, according to the study. Still, the findings don't support that Americans are overarchingly more judgmental or moralistic than in other countries. Based on responses to other questions, Jonathan Evans, senior researcher at Pew, told RNS on Wednesday, Partisan politics seems to play a role in Americans' response to that question. 60% of Democrats rated other Americans' morality as bad, while 46% of Republicans agreed. And according to Pew, there's a rise in both Republicans and Democrats considering those in the other party as immoral. Though Christians were among the religious groups most likely to condemn certain behaviors, views differed widely across countries, Evans said. Overall, people who said religion is very important in their lives were more likely to condemn certain behaviors as morally wrong than other adults were. The countries surveyed include Brazil, France, Nigeria, Sweden, and India. The center surveyed 28,333 people outside the U.S. from January to April 2025. In the U.S., the results came from 3,605 members of its American Trends Panels pool, interviewed in March of 2025, and from 8,937 people who took part in its May 2025 American Trends Panel survey. A majority of Christians in Africa, Latin America, and the U.S. said abortion was morally wrong, while Christians in Europe were less likely to say so. Across Europe, 4 in 10 Christians said abortion was morally wrong. In Sweden, only 7% of Christians agreed. The survey also pointed to Muslims having diverse viewpoints about abortion in at least 2 countries. In Indonesia, 93% of Muslims said having an abortion was morally unacceptable, the highest rate of all countries surveyed, while only 33% of Muslims living in Israel did. Jewish Americans and Jewish Israeli also hold varying views on the issue, with 21% of Jewish Americans saying abortion is unacceptable, while 43% of Jewish Israelis said so. That could be because Orthodox Jews, who tend to be more conservative, are a larger share of the population of Israeli Jews than those of the U.S. Religiously unaffiliated people, also called nuns, who declared to be an atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular, were less likely to say abortion was morally unacceptable compared with religious people. Still, a majority of nuns in Brazil and South Africa said abortion was wrong, while only 1 in 10 nuns in Europe said so, pointing to cultural differences. In 13 countries, Pew examined differences in the views between Catholics and Protestants. In all countries, they had similar views on most issues, but homosexuality. Protestants were harsher than their Catholic counterparts. In the U.S., which had the greatest gap, 59% of Protestants condemned homosexuality compared with 34% of Catholics. Out of the 9 behaviors this center asked about, abortion, viewing pornography, gambling, drinking alcohol, having an extramarital affair, homosexuality, getting a divorce, using contraceptives, and using marijuana, extramarital affairs drew the strongest disapproval. More than half of the respondents across countries condemned it. The U.S. was among the countries where respondents were most likely to disapprove of having an affair. 9 in 10 Americans did, similar to Turks and Indonesians. Meanwhile, the French and Germans were among the least likely to say having an extramarital affair was morally unacceptable, with 53% and 55% respectively condemning it. American adults were among the most accepting of marijuana use and gambling, with 23% and 29% condemning them respectively. In most countries, upward of 40% considered gambling and marijuana morally wrong. Using contraceptives and getting a divorce drew the least disapproval across countries. Homosexuality, however, was one of the issues that saw the least consensus. A majority of Nigerians and Indonesians, 96% and 93% respectively, condemned it. Meanwhile, in Sweden and Germany, only 5% said being homosexual was morally wrong. Almost 4 in 10 Americans, 39%, said homosexuality was wrong. Similarly, views on abortion varied widely from one country to another. Half the adults in Latin America and African countries said abortion was morally unacceptable, while most in European countries said it was acceptable or not a moral issue at all. In total, 47% of American adults said having an abortion was morally unacceptable. Gambling was also a divisive issue. Pew found 10 countries in which most people condemned it, and 10 other countries where most people said it was either acceptable or not a moral issue. According to the report, views seem to have softened on most issues since the center first asked those questions. Moral disapproval generally declined since the center first asked about the issues in 2013, though it varies by issue. Of the 22 countries surveyed on these questions in 2013, half have seen most people soften their views on divorce, except for India, where disapproval for it increased by 12 percentage points, mostly driven by Indian women. Meanwhile, the number of Kenyans who disapproved of divorce dropped from 59% to 30%. Overall, women were more likely to classify certain behaviors as morally wrong, particularly viewing pornography, gambling, drinking alcohol, and using marijuana. Women in almost every country were more likely to condemn viewing pornography than their male counterparts. In the U.S., 58% of women said viewing pornography was morally unacceptable, while 47% of men did. However, men were more likely than women to say homosexuality was morally unacceptable. In countries with significant gender gaps in opinions about homosexuality, men were almost 10 percentage points more likely to condemn it. Greeks were the most divided on the issue, with 40% of men disapproving of homosexuality and only 20% of women. The report reveals that education level also was related to respondents' attitudes towards some of these behaviors. Less educated people were more likely to make moral judgments than more educated people. Overall, adults over 40 years old were more likely to cast the behaviors as morally wrong, particularly gambling, drinking alcohol, and viewing pornography. However, younger generations aged 18 to 39 were more likely than older generations to condemn extramarital affairs. In every country, younger respondents tended to hold views on the morality of their fellow citizens similar to those of older generations. Yet the U.S. was the only place where younger Americans were more likely than older Americans to rate their fellow citizens as morally bad. 57% of American adults under 40 said the morals of people in their country were bad, while 50% of Americans over 40 agreed. And this is the end of this article. Our next article for today is entitled Oscar-nominated Forever Green, Reimagined Story of Christian Grace. The global smash hit The Chosen, the speculative biographical series about Jesus and his disciples, has inspired major streaming channels to tap other biblical sources. Moses is getting his close-up on Netflix, while King David has two shows, Prime Video's House of David and Fox Nation's docudrama David, King of Israel. But historically, some of the most far-reaching Christian cultural touchstones have reimagined biblical themes through allegory. Think C.S. Lewis' Chronicles of Narnia or J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, which put biblical teachings about temptation, redemption, and sacrifice in a fantasy package. The success of this approach can be seen in recent Academy Award nomination for Forever Green, a 12-minute movie from Disney animators that conveys the Christian gospel through allegory. The film's textured, almost tactile animation is combined with a soundtrack that blends folk music with sweeping orchestration to tell a story about unmerited grace, the idea that humans are saved not by their good deeds, but by the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. But unless you're looking for it, The Christian message isn't overt until the closing title card, which quotes John 15:13. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friend. The film, which is free to view on YouTube, follows an orphaned bear cub and a fatherly evergreen tree in an idyllic woodland setting. The initial idea for the story was inspired by the 1989 Christian children's book, The Tale of Three Trees, a classic that was a staple of Sunday school bookshelves in the 90s and aughts. That folktale explores how three trees become part of God's greater purpose as they are refashioned into a manger, a boat, and a cross during Jesus' life on earth. Nathan Engelhart, a longtime Disney animator who moonlighted to make the movie, is a Reformed evangelical Christian. He said he was leveled by the book story when it fell into his hands. I wept after reading it. And just seeing how these trees' dreams were dashed to pieces, but God still used these trees in a unique, particular way, he said. When Jeremy Spears, a friend of Engelhart's, who works as a story artist at Disney, joined the project in 2019 as the movie's writer and co-director, the filmmakers set out to tell a story of unmerited grace with the same quiet power. Retaining themes from The Tale of Three Trees, they invented a new story relying on two images, a photo of a fallen redwood tree creating a bridge over a chasm, and an image of Jesus' cross bridging the gap between humanity and God. When Spears mentioned these images, Engelhart said he had the same image of the cross bridging the divide sitting on his office desk. It really felt like God was saying, "Go make that film," said Spears. Spears' wood carving of a bear became the model for the orphaned cub. "God saved me," Spears said. "I am that bear in the film, and that I had to let go of the things that were holding me back, and I had to reach up to God who had already fallen across the divide." The movie was made with the contributions of more than 200 volunteers working nights and weekends over more than 5 years. Inviting friends and colleagues to be a part of their passion project, Spears and Engelhart knew was a big ask. Each filmmaker has 4 kids, and work on the film often began after their children had been put to bed. The directors also knew the project's religious themes might not be for everyone. "We wanted to make sure that people knew that, hey, this does have a spiritual component to it," said Engelhart. "We want to make sure that you know how we're going to be speaking about the film afterwards, and no hard feelings if you want to back out." Their transparency was met with enthusiasm. Mike Gortz, director of worldwide marketing for Disney, who promoted the film, is a pastor's kid and an evangelical Christian. Gortz said it was an absolute joy to work on a project where you can bring your whole self, you can bring your faith, you can bring God into that space. Spears and Engelhart tapped Christian singer-songwriter Josh Garrels and producer and composer Isaac Wardle to be composers. Josh Garrels is a sort of a soul of the soundtrack. "Maybe I'm the architect of it," quipped Wardle, co-founder of the Porter's Gate, a worship project that, since 2017, has brought together Christian songwriters, pastors, and theologians to write congregational songs on topics such as Advent, work, and mental health. Working from the team's sketches, Wardle relied on instruments with earthly textures, a banjo, an upright bass, a mandolin. The musicians improvised a short musical theme based on their impressions of computer sketches of the film's characters. Eventually, the soundtrack incorporated whistling, full orchestration, and Garrels' later layered vocalizations. The film's only spoken words are sung by Garrels in the final song. "Forever my love, forever my life, for yours," Garrels sings. "We will be forever green." "In the polarized climate of the United States," said Wardell, "people are forming the Christian imagination by defining who's in or who's out, or triumphing over our neighbors. What makes the message of forever green timely," he said, "is its focus on unconditional love, not human triumph." Nathan and Jeremy, They're not working in the field of Christian storytelling. They're working in the field of cultural storytelling, said Wardell. It's so important for us to offer up these visions of Christian faithfulness where we are forming the imagination to see winning not as being about exerting violence over someone else, but actually about understanding that God has taken violence on our behalf. Spears suggested the idea was to tell a story for anyone, not only Christians. What if we could share our faith, share what the gospel message is, he said, but do it in a way that's hospitable to everybody, that's something that we can have all come around, no matter what walk of life you are, no matter what belief system you have. And this is the end of this story. The next article is entitled, Iran's Reprisals Shutter Israel's Houses of Worship During Ramadan and Purim. Early Saturday morning of February 28th, as Israeli and American fighter jets began striking targets in Iran, every Israeli cell phone issued an air raid siren alarm, the signal to go immediately to the nearest bomb shelter. Soon afterward, the country's home front command announced that no public gatherings would be permitted due to fears that Iran would soon retaliate. The safety ban on public gatherings has shuttered not only the country's schools, non-essential workplaces, and airports, but also its churches, mosques, and synagogues. For Muslims celebrating Ramadan and Jews preparing for their holiday of Purim, which begins on Monday at sundown, there is a palpable sense of loss in the closures of their houses of worship. Christians, meanwhile, are looking ahead to Holy Week, which begins at the end of March, with uncertainty. The disappointment was compounded when Homefront Command took the highly unusual step of placing the Old City of Jerusalem, home to the Western Wall, Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and dozens of other sites held sacred in three Abrahamic faiths, off limits to everyone but residents, clergy, and essential workers. The day before the attacks, up to 80,000 Muslims were able to pray at Al-Aqsa, but mass prayers this coming Friday appeared doubtful. When the sirens wailed on Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, Jews already in synagogue scrambled to the closest bomb shelter to conclude their prayers, while those preparing to go to the synagogue sheltered in place. On Sunday, Christian clergy throughout Israel held prayers, but to mostly empty pews. Priests will celebrate mass as usual, but no one can come, said Farah Jubram, the spokesman for the Catholic Patriarchate of Jerusalem, referring to Homefront Command's new guidelines. And I'm afraid we're not going to be able to finish that article because we've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Katie Neuhauser, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.